So we were in the middle of a discussion related to this concept, which I call the biblical roots of Midrashic stories. We introduced the concept last week where we suggested that there's a methodology that cuts across many different genre of Midrashim. Not all, certainly not all, but many different genre of Midrashim, in which we find that Chazal use biblical stories as a back, or biblical events, or verses, or concepts, as a backdrop to new application of a similar story in a different part of Tanakh, with the explicit intent, or the implicit intent, I should say, of linking, of connecting these two events. So in particular, we saw with regards to the most, let's call it the most famous examples, you know, before we start with the sources, I can just talk to you. We saw the most famous examples, which were Abraham being thrown into the furnace of Nimrod for his refusal to participate in the idolatry of Nimrod. Abraham breaking his father's idols as a kind of a prerequisite or pre-step to his own arrival on the scene of history. And we saw both of those midrashim in the context of other biblical stories. So Abraham breaking his father's idols links us to the story of Gideon, who was told explicitly to break his father's idolatrous altar to Baal before Gideon was given the mandate to go and lead Israel into battle. We saw Abraham's story of being thrown into the furnace of Nimrod against the backdrop of the story of Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah in Daniel Perek Gimel being thrown into the furnace of Nebuchadnezzar for refusing to bow down to the statue of Nebuchadnezzar made out of pure gold. And similar other examples, and we're going to look at a few more today. We saw the introduction to the story of the Akedah, where the Medrash introduces the notion of the Satan as a kind of enticement to the test of Abraham and the Akedah. And we saw that against the story of Eov, where the Satan appears in the introduction of Eov. And again, to compare, and in each of these instances, we suggested that the reason the Medrash does this is because there's a profound link to each of these pairs. Abraham in his war against the Kedar LaOmer, who goes to war with 318 men. Gideon, who goes to war against the army of Midian with 300 soldiers. Abraham and the story of the Tower of Babel, which is not explicit in the text, but almost explicit in the text in terms of the chronology of the events, and that connecting certainly to Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah and the Tower of Babel and Nebuchadnezzar. So the Akedah and Eov, Rashi, the notion that that Job or Eov is in a sense a background to Abraham, almost as if the contemporaries and the connection or the parallel explains to us why Abraham was chosen and Eov was not, if you will, in that regard. What we're going to do for the remainder of the time that we have today is to look at more examples, because this is so dramatic in my understanding of it. The way when I first heard this or understood this, it was such an eye-opening moment for me in terms of understanding of Midrash that I've literally been collecting these examples over the years. And I think we really only get the breadth of this notion or this idea if we look at multiple examples in different genre of Midrash. And so I'm going to, that's sort of the goal for today, is to look at a number of different further examples, again, in different kinds of genre of Midrash. So we're going to now go back to the source pages, Biblical Roots of Midrashic Stories, Part 2. And we're going to start with, I mentioned this at the very end of the shiur last week, which is the beginning of Moshe's life. Medrash states that Hashem Tzadik Yivchan, that God tests the righteous. B'mo bochno, how does God test the righteous? B'mir etzon, with the characteristic of a shepherd. And meaning the Medrash starts with a list of all of the great leaders of our people who started as shepherds, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, David, Moshe, David, etc. But then the Medrash zeroes in on Moshe. The Af Moshe lo bachno ela betzon, Moshe himself was tested through sheep, as it says, teach Rabbeinu, our rabbis taught, Gishayam Moshe ro etzon shel Yitro b'midbar, when Moshe was was tending the flock of Yitro in the desert. And he noticed that a little kid goat had escaped, and he ran after it until he saw that this goat had reached a shady place. And then he realized that the kid had come to a pool of water and had stopped to drink. Moshe caught up and said, I had no idea that you ran away because you were thirsty. If I would have known, I would have brought you here myself, implies the Medrash. Hirkivo al ktefo bayamalech. So the Moshe then took the kid and put it on his shoulders and walked him back. You have this kind of compassion when you lead a flock of an earthly flock, let's call it. On your life, you will lead my flock. And therefore it says, beginning of the story of Moshe starts when Moshe is keeping the flock of Yitro. Now, there's a number of pieces of the story that are backdrops to this that are important to note. First of all, the notion that Israel is compared to a flock and that we are, in a sense, God's flock, that too is a biblical reference. In fact, it's a biblical reference expressed by Moshe himself. And if you look in Bamidbar Parak Chav Zayin as the end of Moshe's life, when Moshe is worried about appointing a successor, he makes the declaration, Yifkod Hashem Elokei Ruchot L'cho Basar Isha Laida, may God, the spirit, God of the spirit of all flesh, set a man over the congregation, a leader, to replace me, because Moshe's life was coming to an end. Ashi Yetzeh Lifnehem, Ashi Yavol Lifnehem, will lead them in and out of war. Vashi Yotzeh Ashi Yaviyem. V'lo Tiyeh Adat Hashem Katzon Asher En Lahem Mo'eh. And let the congregation of God not be like a flock of sheep without a shepherd. So the notion that Israel is God's flock, so to speak, and the leader appointed is the shepherd of God's flock, is a reference that comes straight out of the Chumash in Bamidbar Chav Zayin. It's certainly the backdrop to the roles that are being played out in this Medrash. But that's only a very small part of the picture. The much bigger part of the picture is that this Medrash paints the story of Moshe as kind of the moment of his appointment as the leader of Israel, because he was so careful to follow and to look after the flock to the last one, to the one that was lost. And he went running after looking for that one that got lost. And so God says, this kind of compassion is worthy of leadership of my flock. That's what the Medrash says. And we have exactly that story. And that's my thesis. It's not my thesis. That's what I'm trying to share with you, which is that this story exists in Tanakh. It's not like it's a Midrashic story the Chazal made up. It's a biblical account. Just the names are changed to, not even to protect the innocent in this case, but to link the stories. Where do we have an account of somebody who is destined to be the first leader of Israel, just like Moshe was appointed to be the first leader of Israel? And that moment of his appointment is an encounter with God's message, which begins with his looking after the lost flock of his father. Those are the paradigms. And that story, exactly as I just described it, is the moment in which Saul, encounters the Navi Shmuel in his first message that he was going to be appointed as the first king of Israel. And that story is in Shmuel Aleph Perek Tet. It begins as follows. Vatovadna ha'atonot l'kish avi Shaul. Kish is the father of Shaul. He has a flock, in this case, a flock of donkeys, and that one of those donkeys went missing. One or many, that doesn't say, but Tabadna Atanot, the donkeys of Kish went missing. Vayomer Kish el Shaul beno, kach neitchat achad me'anarim v'kum lech bakesh et ha'atanot. Go take your servant with you and go look for, go find the lost donkeys. So they went looking, they were looked in Har Ephraim, they looked in Eretz Shalisha, they looked all around. They couldn't find the donkeys. They went throughout the land of Binyamin. Finally, at that time they came to the land of Tzuf. Saul said to his lad, let's go home, because if we wait too long, if we stand here too long, then our father will start worrying about us more than he is worried about the donkeys, because we've been gone for 3 days. And at which point the Na'ai makes a suggestion, there's an Isha Lakim, but your result, there's an Isha Lakim, there's a Navi in this place, why don't we go and seek his counsel? And that's exactly what they do. The rest of the story, I'm not going to, I didn't put on the source page. I think it's understood. The rest of the story is that he goes and he encounters Shmuel, and Shmuel was sitting there waiting for him because God had told Shmuel that this person would come to him, etc. So you have, in the same way you have Moshe at the burning bush, where he encounters God's messenger, the Malach, who says to him, you have been appointed to lead the people of Israel, Shaul encounters Shmuel, who tells him, you have been appointed to lead my people Israel. Shaul's story begins with him looking after or searching for the lost Atonot. The Medrash connects the stories by telling us, Moshe's story begins with him looking after the lost, looking for the sheep that went astray, as Shaul was looking for the donkey that went astray. So the parallel between these stories is really striking. But as I said last week, that's only the beginning. Because the real power of this thesis is that it then says to us, as we begin to read the story of Shaul, that we need to be thinking Shaul and Moshe. The Medrash is already linking us to two events that we in our minds need to be saying, okay, what are the parallels between Moshe and Shaul? Well, certainly the simplest parallel is that Moshe is the first Navi and Shaul is the first Melech. So Moshe is the first person to lead our people physically, politically, as a leader of Israel, as the Melech, Ibishur Melech. And Shaul was the first formal king of Israel. So there's certainly both in the category of firsts. There are other parallels too. But as we begin to read the story of Shaul, suddenly that parallel or that link jumps off the page for us. So for example, and I've given you in the next page and a half a chart with a bunch of different both textual and thematic parallels between the story of Moshe and the story of Shaul. So this is a continuation of the same chapter, Shmuel Aleph Perek Tet, which is the same chapter where Shmuel encounters Shaul encounters Shmuel. Hashem galat ozen Shmuel yom achad lifnei bo Shaul lemor. The day before Shaul had come, Shmuel had been told by God that ka'et machar, this time tomorrow, which is also a phrase that links to the story of Yetziat Mitzrayim, makat b'chavot, but I'll leave that for now. Tomorrow I will send you a man from Eretz Binyamin. You will anoint him as the leader of my people Israel. Because he is destined to save my people from the hands of the Plishtim. Ki ra'iti et ami, ki ba'at sa'akato elai. For I have seen my people's affliction, and their cry has come to me. And if you think about Moshe's encounter at the burning bush, which is also the continuation of that midrashic introduction, Moshe searching for the sheep and he encounters the burning bush, right? That's exactly the language that is used. Ro'o ra'iti et ani ami, I see my affliction of Israel. Etzakatam shamati, and I hear and I've heard their affliction, their cry. Ba'atzakatoila. Tzakat b'nei Yisrael ba'elai. Their cry has come to me. And therefore, go, Eshlachacha, Paro, I will send you to Paro. The same way Shaul is told, Eshlachacha, God is sending Shaul to Shmuel. Their mission starts with almost the same mandate. God, Moshe to take Bnei Yisrael out of Mitzrayim, Shaul to save Israel from the hands of the Plishtim. Then it gets even more intriguing because the reaction of both of them is almost identical. Shmuel's reaction to this moment is, Halo ben Yemini Anochi Miktanei Shivtei Yisrael. I am but a member of the tribe of Binyamin, one of the smallest of the tribes of Israel, and my family is of the youngest of the tribes of Binyamin. Why do you speak thus to your servant? What did Moshe say in response to God's appointment? Mi Anochi Ki Elecha Paro, who am I that I should go to Paro and take Bnei Yisrael out of Mitzrayim? That sense of anivus, of modesty, of humble, of humility, characteristic of both of these great individuals. And then it goes even further, because then you have throughout the story various phrases that appear in both contexts. We have in the story the Battle of Michmas by Shmuel, by Shaul, it says, by Shaul, by Yosh Hashem by Yom Huot Yisrael, God saved Israel at that time, at that day. The same language used by Yamsuf, by Yosh Hashem by Yom Huot Yisrael. But the most fascinating parallel of all, I think, is the notion that that Shaul is given three signs to prove the integrity of God's message to him. This is already a more complicated piece because I didn't go through the whole chapter, but in the follow-up chapter, in chapter 10, Shaul is told that as you leave here, you're going to encounter three events that are signs for you that, in fact, God is with you and that this is all happening because there was an element of doubt in Shaul's mind. And so Shmuel says to him, "Yaki tavona ha'otot ha'ela, when these signs will come about, lech aselech asher timtzei yadecha ki alokim imach, you will know that God is with you." And what does God say to Moshe at the burning bush? Vayomer ki eyeh imach. God says to him, "I will be with you, and this is the sign that I have sent you." And how many signs did God give to Moshe at the burning bush? Three. And the parallels are striking. Until, and on this you'll hear from me many times, whether in this context or in other shiurim that I've given or will give. I believe very strongly that almost every time there's a parallel between two events or two personalities in Tanakh, almost without exception, the purpose of that parallel is not so much what is the same, but to highlight where the differences are. Because as much as the parallels draw us in, we then get to the end. And in the end, we find the most extraordinary difference. When Shaul was finally anointed king, at that coronation ceremony, if you will, or at that moment of his anointment, Shaul went to hide because he was so humble that he simply couldn't believe that this was going to happen about him. And so he went hiding. And because he didn't even show up at the ceremony, he had to be found. There were those amongst his people, Bnei Belial, Amu Mayosh Yenizeh, who doubted him. Now, it's true that Moshe had his detractors and who doubted him too. And of Moshe, it says, Ve'nish, and Moshe, anav mikol adam, he was more humble than any person upon the earth. Whereas Moshe's humility was his strength, and Moshe knew when to emerge from his humility to stand firm in his leadership. Shaul's humility ultimately is his undoing. And so from the very same origins, we come to a very different end. Whereas Shmuel comes to Shaul and holds him accountable for his lack of humility in the case of Gilgal and in the case of Amalek, where he listened to the people his over humility, where his sense of loyalty, of leadership was such, or the lack of confidence in his leadership was such, that he ended up listening to the people where he shouldn't have. And so God says to him through Shmuel, says to Shaul, "Vayomer Shmuel Haloim Katanata Benecha Rosh Shiftei Yisrael Ata." If you think yourself small in your own eyes, you were the leader of the people of Israel. And Shaul's response is, "I've sinned. I've violated God's command. Ki yareti et ha'am, because I was afraid of the people, and I listened to the people, whether it be in the case of Amalek or in the case of Gilgal." When Moshe was challenged, when Moshe had to face down the people because his leadership was challenged, the most dramatic case is the case of Korach. Moshe knew how to stand firm. He knew how to stand firm against Paro. He knew how to stand firm against the people in the case of the rebellion of Korach. He even knew how to stand firm against the Kadosh Baruch Hu after the sin of the golden calf. So whereas Moshe's humility is part of his character, he knows how to balance it and weave it into a personality of leadership, Shaul's humility, which is the same as Moshe, but it ultimately is his undoing at the end of his story. And that is reflected in this passage in the Gemara in Yuma, in which Rabbi Yehuda says in the name of Rav, why was Shaul punished, meaning why did Shaul fail? Because he forwent his royal honor, meaning he was so humble that there were moments when he needed to stand up and be kingly and lead, and he couldn't. And that was his undoing. So here, and this comes back to what I started with, here you have an example of, I go back to the Medrash, a simple story about Moshe and the lost sheep. If you're thinking the way I believe Chazal thought, which was they first mastered Tanakh and knew all the stories of Tanakh by heart, then they said, okay, take the story of Shaul and read into the story of Moshe that same origin. Well, now suddenly I have two stories that I'm going to read in parallel, in contrast. And it changes our whole understanding of Shaul in the constant reference and comparisons to Moshe all the way through. So that's another example of this idea of seeing a story in one part of Tanakh as the background to a medrash in another part of Tanakh that is designed to create a kind of association in my mind, the reader's mind, and connect the dots. All right. I'm going to stop for a second. If anybody has a question on this, you can unmute yourself for a second just before I move on to the next genre, because this was kind of a postscript of the genre that we had looked at last week. But I'll take a moment if there's any questions. If not, we're going to move on to this next unit. Next unit is another genre of Midrashim altogether. And this is a phenomenon we find often, where Chazal will take a series of parshiot in Chumash, or a series of mitzvot that appear in Chumash, and kind of analyze the link between them. What Chazal referred to as smichut parshiot, the juxtaposition of one mitzvah next to another. It happens in a number of different places. Rashi mentions it in a few places as well. And what I'm suggesting to you is that I can't say for certain in all cases, but in many of these cases, the drasha around the smichut parshiot, the link of these parshiot, is a biblical account that Chazal have in their minds. Chazal are thinking this event and now applying it and saying, oh, you see how the Torah linked these parshiot? Because we know that they're connected. And here's the event in biblical context that shows how they're connected. Let me give you an example. Devarim Perakhav Aleph. So Devarim Perakhav Aleph begins, and it might be helpful if I actually see it in Chumash. So I'm going to pull this up. Devarim Perakhav Aleph, beginning of Parshat Kitetse. Kitetse l'mechama l'aybacha, you will go out to war against your enemies. And in that context of that war, you will take captives. And v'ra'ita bashivya eshet yifatoa. And amongst the captives, you will see a beautiful woman. And desire her and take her. Then the Torah says, okay, so if you take this beautiful woman as a prisoner of war, here are the rules that you have to implement in order to be allowed to marry her. And parsha, very difficult parsha, known as Eshet Yifat Torah. The next paragraph begins, Ki tiyena le'ish shtei nashim, as a man has two wives, one loved and one hated, one's primary wife, one secondary, and they have children. But as it is not uncommon, the b'chor, the firstborn, is to the secondary wife, not to the one that he loves. Then when he comes to give over the inheritance, the nachla, to his children, he should not forgo the portion of the b'chor. Ki et b'chor menas noa yakir, latet lo pishnai. Next paragraph, ki el ish ben sorer u'morer, if a person has a rebellious son who doesn't listen to his father and his mother, then his parents will take him and bring him to the Beit Din, and as they say in the old country, the rest is history. So here the Torah ends three very difficult mitzvot, difficult to understand, difficult to see the morality of them, difficult to place in context. Eshet Yifat Torah, to marry the prisoner of war, the Bechor issue, right? Two wives, one loved, one not, and the Ben Sorer Morer. Says Rashi, this whole portion of the Eshet Yifat Torah is the Torah's concession to the physical drives of man, to the Yetzer Hara. Shame in a Kadosh Baruch Hu matira yisa ena b'Yisrael. For Kadosh Baruch Hu didn't allow this prisoner of war in this concept of the Eshet Yifat Torah, then the likelihood is that in the heat of battle and in the energy in the moment, he would probably do something with her that he shouldn't be allowed to do. And so the Torah says, okay, let's put it into context that makes it permissible rather than prohibited. However, and here's the but. Aval im nisa'a, but the Torah is warning us that if you succumb to this concession, in the end, you're going to hate her. You're not going to love her. As it says immediately following, two women, one loved, one hated. And if you continue down this path, the child born will be rebellious. Therefore, the Torah linked these parashiyot. That's Rashi. Now Rashi is quoting a Medrash, and in this case, the Medrash helps us in this thesis, because the Medrash does exactly what I'm suggesting to you, which is the actual source of the Medrash spells it out, that there is a biblical account that is sitting in the forethought of Chazal when they're composing this concept of Smichut Parshiot, the link between these two mitzvot. They're thinking of a story in Tanakh. They're not just arbitrarily darshaning, this story is linked to this, is linked to this. They're saying in their minds, you know what? Here's the account in Tanakh, and it shows me that these are connected. Kol man denasi, this is the Medrash Tanchuma that Rashi is quoting. Kol man denasi Yifat Torah, anyone who marries a Yifat Torah, a woman of pretty form, meaning this prisoner of war, a person sees and desires, nafik minayo ben sorer u'morer, the end result will be a rebellious son. Sheken katav b'David, And the example is right there in front of our eyes. The story of David HaMelech. Now, here too, the Medrash does a classic switch. Because the obvious case of David HaMelech is not written in this Medrash. The obvious case of David HaMelech we'll get to in a second, which is what I think Chazal started with. But Chazal linked it to, again, another kind of midrashic moment. Suggesting that David had a desire for Ma'acha, the daughter of Talmai, the king of Geshur, in a battle that David fought, and therefore married her. Ma'acha bat Talmai Melech Geshur is one of David's wives, the mother of Avshalom. And Chazal was suggesting that she was a Eshet Yifator. David had seen her in battle and taken her as part of his desire, and that was his Eshet Yifator. But Avshalom was the rebellious son. Shalom led the rebellion against David that ultimately brought David to his knees and exiled him from Yerushalayim. Yatzam imenu Avshalom shebikesh lo rego. And not only that, v'shachavim eser pilag gishav l'neko yisro l'nei Hashemesh. Avshalom took David's concubines and slept with them on the rooftop of his palace. V'al yadon nergum yisro kamer levavot. And how many tens of thousands of people died in the battle of the civil war with Avshalom? As a machloket b'Israel, which eventually came to the story of Shimon ben Gera, Shimon ben Bichri, and Achitofel. And on and on and on. All spiraling out of control from the rebellion of Avshalom because David desired Ma'acha bat Talmai Melech Geshur. Now, this is an extraordinary moment, Medrash, because it's exactly the smichut parashiyot. Eshet Yifator to the conflict between the wives, to the rebellious child of Shalom. But what the Medrash does is it skips the obvious, which is that the real Yifator here in the story of David is not Ma'acha bat Talmai Melech Geshur. The real Yifator here in the pshat of it is Batsheva. She's the Yifator that David sees from his rooftop while the rest of his people are out on the battlefield. And that ultimately leads to the story of Amnon and Tamar and the rebellion of Avshalom. And I'm in my Navi class this year, and I'm teaching Shmuel Bet, we're going through the story of David and Batsheva in detail. But it's if you know the story, you know the link between the story of David and Batsheva and all of the events described in this Medrash. So she may not technically be the Yifator in the formal sense of prisoner of war, but she's certainly in the context in which David is succumbing to his Yetzer Hara, to his evil inclination, which leads to the series of events that follow. And so the story of David is clearly in the focus of Chazal as they are perceiving the link between these two events. So again, this is not exactly the same kind of midrashic story that's being transposed, but a biblical account that's serving as the backdrop to their interpretation of these links between mitzvot, the smichut parashiyot. I'll give you another example of this same kind of genre, and we'll see another paradigm. This is a different link. This is the link between the mitzvah of Sota and the mitzvah of the Nazir. Gemara in Brachos, which actually is in Parshat Naso, it's coming up. The Gemara in Brachos says, Tanya Rebbe Omer, why does the section of the Nazirite follow immediately on the heels of the section of the Sota, the unfaithful, or this is a bad translation. The Sota is not an unfaithful wife. The Sota is a woman whose behavior leads to suspicion of being unfaithful and is so accused by her husband. Right? And the purpose of the warders of the Sota is to evaluate her guilt or innocence. So it's a little bit of a translation. Shekein haro es Sota bekilkula, to teach us that anybody who sees the story of the shame brought to this Sota in the Mikdash, with Kilkula, Yazir Atzmo Menayin needs to shift his energy into a different direction by becoming a Nazir from wine. Now, you have to sit there and scratch your heads and ask yourself, what on earth are Chazal doing? What possible connection is there between Sota and Nazir? Now, you could, on a simple level, Rashi quotes this in Chumash, on a simple level, you could say, okay, a person is, what the Gemara is saying is that we live in a kind of a delicate balance between sanctity and Yetzer Hara. And if a person sees a moment which kind of chips away at their sense of sanctity and purity, they need to shift to the other extreme. Okay. But I don't think so. I think that there's something much more concrete going on. And the Chazal are linking in their minds two genres. The concept of the Sota, which is a kind of relationship between men and women that is far less pure and far more complex than would be the norm of what we would anticipate in Jewish life, with the concept of the Nazir, who is adding restrictions to their life that aren't the same for everybody else. So the context of a Sota, now the Sota is both her and the suitor who is involved in that relationship, assuming that it's true, right? There is a certain lack of control that they reflect, that they represent. And the Nazir, who is adding an element of control to his life beyond that which the Torah demands. And so there's a certain contrast between them. But even that's insufficient. I don't think Chazal would have linked these two were it not for a classic example standing, staring them in the face. Of whom can it be said that they represent, on the one hand, a kind of loose relationship with women that is an extraordinary paradigm in Tanakh that we would never allow in any other circumstance for any other person, certainly not a leader of Israel, and at the same time is a Nazir, and who in their personality links these two, the Sota and the Nazir. And the answer is Shimshon. Shimshon is exactly the convergence of the story of the Sota and the story of the Nazir. Remember that Shimshon is predetermined to be a Nazir from birth. The only example of somebody born and to which the Malach says he is going to be a Nazir from birth. And his Nazirut is tied to the end of his life, the end of his story. But at the same time, there's another role that is sort of set up for Shimshon. Vayered Shimshon Timnata, when Shimshon, beginning of his story in Perek Yudalet, goes down to Timna, and he sees a woman there from amongst the women of the Philistines, and he goes home to his father and his mother, and he says to them, Ishara iti b'timnata mibnot plishtim, I saw a Philistine woman, and I desire her, give her to me as a wife. It's a classic phrase. His father and mother said to him, is there no Jewish woman amongst all of you, the daughters of your brothers and amongst my people, that you should go and take yourself a wife from the Philistines? It's flabbergasted, jaw dropping. No, I want her. She pleases me. You can just place the conversation in any context you want. And here comes one of the most difficult psukim in all of Tanakh. His father and mother did not understand that this was by God's design. For God sought a pretext against the Philistines, for the Philistines were ruling over Israel. And God sought to send Shimshon into the lair of the Philistines, literally to be amongst them, to live amongst them, to marry amongst them, to be so drawn to the women of the Philistines that he would become a thorn in their side and ultimately begin the process of undoing their power over Israel. But from that perspective, where is Shimshon's free will? Where is his bechira? Where is his whole life is predetermined and prescripted to be a pretext to have this lust and desire for Philistine women? And this I learned from Rav Meidan, an extraordinary observation, that that's exactly what the role of being a Nazir was to do, was to give Shimshon back his free will. He says, when it comes to the Philistine women, this was by God's design, but his nizirut, his loyalty to the regimen of the Nazir was a kind of test for Shimshon, a balance for Shimshon to be able to hold that balance between what God needed him to do and what his free will allowed him to do. And at the end of his story, he fails because he gives up on his nizirut, and therefore he gives up on the one domain of his free will. But the story of the Sota and the story of the Nizirut converges in the context of Shimshon in a way that we would not have. There's two things going on here, right? At the same time, Chazal are both inside, in both explaining to us the background to Shimshon as much as it is the background to Shimshon which informs this Midrashic observation. I'm going to skip the second example. I have another example of the same idea, but you can already use your imagination. The other individual who finds himself in an extraordinary moment of weakness opposite a woman is Yosef, by the wife of Potiphar. And at the last moment, he's able to explicate himself from that trap. Chazal say that Chazal import to Yosef the status of a Nazir. His hair and he's not drinking wine, etc., for the same reason that it kind of borrows from the world of Shimshon. Okay, so that's the two examples from the world of Smichut Parashiyot, this kind of juxtaposition of stories of Tanakh that are of mitzvot on the Torah that are again also built on the backdrop of biblical events. I'm going to move now to another couple of examples. I sort of want to lead this to a pre-Shavuos message, so hopefully we'll have the time. But I want to throw in one more example of this kind of link between two a biblical event and a midrashic story. In this case, it's a story of Yiftach or Pinchas. Medrash says that if you remember the story of Yiftach, we'll get to Pinchas in a second, but if you remember the story of Yiftach, where Yiftach was judge of Israel, he was a controversial character, a controversial personality. He was originally exiled by his brothers, and then he was brought back to be the leader of Israel as they were facing the combined armies of Ammon and Moab. And so Yiftach is in the midst of the battle, and he makes a very famous comment where he, kind of height of it all, he says to God, if you give me these enemies into my hand, the first one who emerges from my house, I will offer it as a sacrifice to God. And when he comes home from battle, out walks his daughter to greet him from the battlefield. And if you remember the story, I'll just do a quick review. Yiftach is in the midst of the battle, and he says to this is all the introduction. Yiftach took a vow, and he said, "In Natanti tenet b'nei Amon biadi, if God, if you will deliver the children of Ammon to my hands, then whoever steps forth from my house to greet me, I will offer them as a burnt offering to God. Chazal have very harsh things to say about the oath because the slip of the tongue that Yiftach utters, what was he expecting to come out of his house? In the end, it was his daughter. Well, I'm not quite sure what Yiftach was anticipating would come out of his house. So that's complicated. But Ve'avo Yiftach, he comes home victorious, and as he comes home victorious, out walks his daughter. His daughter comes out to greet him with tambourines and with dancing, and she is an only child. As he saw her, he tore his garment, and he said, my daughter, you have brought me low, you have troubled me, you were the source of my trouble. I opened up my mouth to God. I cannot retract it. I cannot go back. And with the exception of one interpretation of the Radak, all the Mefarshim agree, together with Chazal, that Yiftach, in fact, does exactly what he said to do. And she says to Yiftach, if that's what the oath that you took, so be it. So you have to do what you said. You have to do what you said. And he actually kills her and offers her as a sacrifice, according to the vast majority of Mefarsh. A very tragic story. Here says the Medrash. Now we're talking about a neder, right? We're talking about an oath. So an oath is a mechanism to annul an oath. Right? You're familiar with the story of Hatarat Nedarim. You can annul an oath. It has a mechanism. So the Medrash says, "V'loi Yashab Pinchas Shiatirat Nidro." Where was Pinchas? Why was Pinchas the Kohen Gadol not there to annul his oath? Why did he have to go through with it? Why couldn't he just? Right, he certainly didn't anticipate that his daughter would emerge from the house. Says the Medrash, "Ala Pinchas Amar." What did Pinchas say? Pinchas said, "Hutzadichli. He needs to come to me. Why should I go to him? He wants to annul the oath. Let him come to me. I'm the Kohen Gadol." V'yiftach amar, wait a second. Ani rosh k'tzinei Yisrael. I'm the leader of the people of Israel. I'm the leader of the army. Why should I go to him? Let him come to me. V'ani olech li etzal Pinchas. I should go to him? Let him come to me. So Yiftach is sitting there saying, let him come to me. Pinchas is saying, sitting there saying, let him come to me. Then din l'din avda narahi. Between the two of them, the daughter of Israel, this daughter, perished. And Chazal and this Medrash are very harsh. They clearly place blame for the story of the tragedy of Yiftach's daughter at the feet of Yiftach and Pinchas. Remember Pinchas from Chumash? The zealot? You have to ask yourself the obvious question. This is 300 years after Yitzhak Mitzrayim. Is the Medrash suggesting here that Pinchas is 350 years old?
Doesn't the Mitra say Pinchas is Eliyahu as well?
And so that we dealt with last week, that clearly Chazal did not, I don't believe, Chazal meant for that to be taken literally. That Pinchas is 400, 500, 600 years old, and therefore he becomes Eliyahu. I just don't see that in any kind of context, which Chazal meant to suggest that a person could live that long in that context, especially when the Torah says that 120 was a limit. Right. Where Pinchas enters into the story, we'll see. But this is a fascinating moment. And then Chazal do something else. Shnehem ne'enshu b'damei shel nara. They're both punished for her blood. How are they punished? So I'll get to Yiftach in a second. How is Pinchas punished? Pinchas nitla mimenu ruach hakodesh. He is defrocked. He's removed, the power of Ruach HaKodesh leaves him, meaning he is no longer able to serve as the high priest. As it says, Pinchas ben Elazar, Nagid Alehem, Pinchas ben Elazar was the leader over the people. He was the leader over them. It doesn't say he is, it says he was. Meaning he was fired. Pinchas, who was the Kohen Gadol, was fired from his role of the Kohen Gadol for his failure here. And Yiftach is also punished here. Met b'nishilat evarim. He died, you'll forgive the graphic description of it, with the drop of his limbs. Literally, he would lose limb by limb. Every time he went somewhere, kom kom she'olech, aya ever nishol mimenu, one of his limbs would fall off. And they would bury that limb there. Because it says, v'yamot yiftach v'yikaber b'arei Gilad. Yiftach was buried in the cities of the Gilad, in the plural. And you have to, it's like extraordinary. What is Yiftach, limbs falling off, and Pinchas, who's 350 years old? I'm just kind of astounded.
Why can't you say that they were Gilgolim?
I because in the Pshat of Tanakh, Gilgul Neshamas doesn't exist. That is a extraordinarily controversial theology between philosophers in the Middle Ages, the Rambam and the Sadigon and others. Gilgul does not exist in the Pshat of Tanakh. So in the Pshat of it, it doesn't work. But again, working off this thesis that Yiftach, that the Medrash is taking biblical stories and reformulating them in other accounts. Here, the Medrash links me to it, and Medrash tells me where to go. Medrash says, okay, there's a story here, but it's not about Yiftach. It's not about Yiftach. Yiftach's issue here is Hatarat Nedarim, is annulling of oaths, and the oaths that should have been annulled that weren't. And Pinchas, who's the zealot who refused, is at fault. Well, do we know any story of an oath that should have been annulled and that wasn't, and that led to catastrophe, and where Pinchas, who was the high priest at the time, who should have annulled, who should have been a man of peace, ended up being the zealot of the man of war, and was defrocked and fired for his role in that story? And I'll give you a hint. That story has something to do with limbs falling off. Nishilat Evarim.
Pilegesh Begiva.
Pilegesh Begiva. Exactly right. Pilegesh Begiva is the story at the end of Sefer Shoftim. And the only thing about Pilegesh Begiva you need to know is that even though it's at the end of Sefer Shoftim, this gets a little bit tricky, but there are two stories at the end of the book of Shoftim which are chronologically out of context. They appear at the end of the book, but they are actually much earlier events that are kind of a postscript to the book. One is Pesel Micha, and the other is Pilegesh Begiva. They are the last two stories in the book of Shoftim. Why they appear out of order is a subject we can discuss. Happy to, if you want to email me, I'm happy to share with you. But it's clear from these two that these two stories are much earlier. And in fact, Chazal explicitly say that the story Pilegesh Begiva is much earlier. It actually is in the early years of the period of the Shoftim, not the later years. But in that story, in Shoftim Parakhaf, all of Israel gathered together as one man to go to fight against the tribe of Binyamin for the story of the Pilegesh, which was this concubine from this man from the tribe of Levi, who had a concubine, and he won't get into all the details, but at the end of the day, there is a story where the people of the city and Binyamin had taken her and had raped her and to the end of her edge of her life, and the late Levite who was refusing who mistreated her took her and literally cut her up into limbs and then distributed the limbs to all of Israel and said, this is what was done to my concubine or to my wife, come and avenge me. And they come and they wage war against the tribe of Binyamin. Right? That one sentence is the story of Pilegesh Begiva. It's one of the most horrific tragedies in Tanakh. But who is the priest at the time? Upinchas ben Elazar ben Aaron omed lefanav b'mimay. The priest at the time who's reading the Urim v'Tumim, who's leading them into battle against their brother Binyamin, who is leading them into battle against the storm Yavesh Gilad, because there's a part two to that story. And the part two to that story is that in their haste to kind of go to war against Binyamin, they took an oath that every tribe of Israel who's not accounted, any tribe of Israel not accounted for at that moment, will be banned from marrying into the people of Israel for eternity. Well, there was a tribe there that wasn't theirs, that named Yavesh Gilad, and Pinchas goes to war with them. There's a series of events all related to Pinchas the Zealot. The story of Bilegish Begiva is the story of the failure of the leadership of Pinchas in the pshat of it. And it's the story of oaths that should never have been taken, oaths to go to battle, oaths against tribes of Israel. And what Chazal are doing in the story of Yiftach, in the oath that should never have happened and the tragedy that comes from it, is that they are linking us back to the story of Pilegesh Begiva. And there we do find Pinchas. And there Pinchas was the Kohen Gadol. But there Chazal is saying Pinchas' failure in Pilegesh Begiva, and it's ultimately Pinchas' fault that the tragedy led to a civil war, is similar to the tragedy of Yiftach. So again, I have the same exercise of linking one story to another. It's much more to be said there, but we run out of time. So I am going to leave you with two stories very briefly without going through the details, just to kind of see them in context.
Rabbi Shulman, I just want to say that Midrashim by definition are not pshat. So I don't know.
Right. So this is the basis of this thesis is that I'm suggesting to you is I never said that Midrashim are by definition not pshat. Midrashim are the rabbinic in the insights of Chazal in every pasuk. Now, whether or not that pshat is a matter of opinion. But the question is, what does Chazal mean? And what I'm trying to suggest is that Chazal saw a deeper pshat, what the Rishonim referred to as Omek Shel Pshuto Shel Mikra, in very often the medrash that seems to or reads to us as not pshat is in fact pshat. It's just drawn from a different place. You understand? That's exactly my thesis. That's why I started by saying from the very first class that midrashim need to be taken seriously, if not literally. Right? But to dismiss the world of medrash and simply say, well, we're doing pshat, medrash is not pshat. Right? So if that's the case, which are you relying on? Are you relying on the medrash and working off a literal reading of the medrash and saying, okay, our worldview is going to be formed by the literal reading of the medrash, even though it's obscure and in places unintelligible and irrational? Or am I going to try to work through these midrashim to try to see what Chazal were the sophisticated game of connect the dots that Chazal were trying to lead our eye to? And am I going to suggest that in this midrash, Yiftach died by his limbs falling off? Or am I suggesting that this medrash, or am I going to read this medrash to mean, that Chazal are drawing our attention to the link between the story of Yiftach and the oaths that should never have been taken to the behavior of Pinchas in the story of Pilegesh Begiva, where we have a story of the limbs being removed? Right? Now, that's exactly my point, is that midrashim are not pshat in the sense, if I take them literally. But if I see the methodology behind the medrash, which is to draw connections between what is pshat in two different places, it opens up a whole world for me in terms of an insight into Chazal. Chazal are not making up stories. This is, if I can convey anything in this series, it's an idea that Chazal are not making up stories. They are drawing on biblical stories from one place to give us insight into another. Unfortunately, we ran out of time, and so I've kind of lost. I don't have. There was two more stories that I wanted to share with you. They're on the source page. I'll just outline them for you in 30 seconds, so you know where they're going. One is the Gemara of by Megillah to Esther about Achashverosh, and there's a whole genre in this medrash about how Achashverosh's party at the beginning of the Megillah was his way of calculating that the 70 years of exile would come to an end and that they had passed. And therefore, he takes out the kelim of the Beis HaMikdash and he uses them to drink from in that party. Apek manid de Beis HaMikdash, he takes out the kelim and he drinks from them. And hence, whenever we read the Megillah, we recite the phrase, v'kelim, kelim shonim, in the tune of Echa, if you remember. Now, Achashverosh, I don't think, is throwing a party in the pshat of the story of the Megillah, has nothing to do with the 70 years of exile. His pshat of throwing this party has nothing to do with the calculation of the Beit HaMikdash. In fact, there's a whole debate who Achashverosh is, and according to at least one opinion in Chazal, Achashverosh is after the Beit HaMikdash is already built. He's after Dayavish, according to at least one account. What are Chazal doing in this Medrash is they're linking it to another biblical story of the same era. Namely, and this gets back to Daniel, Perek Hay, which is that we do have a story in Tanakh of a king in that region feasting to celebrate the end of the 70 years of exile prophecy, and the uses the kalim, the vessels of the Beit HaMikdash, and that's Belshazzar, the last Babylonian king, who dies that night, the famous story of the writing on the wall, right? And he brought the clay azav asher tzu mina echal asher bishlaim, and he did drink out of the vessels. And so that story, again, is in Tanakh, and Chazal are linking the story of Achashverosh to the story of Belshazzar. Why, again, is there for your understanding and deeper analysis, which we'll leave for now because we're out of time. And the last one I was going to share with you is the story of Purim. Chazal's drasha that Purim was a kind of acceptance of the Torah or reacceptance of the Torah, because the first time we stood at Har Sinai, it was forced. That was a Shavuos issue. That notion that we reaccepted the Torah willingly was not in Megillat Esther. It's really in Sefer Nehemiah, where they write an entire declaration and accept and recognize that they're still slaves in to Persia, they're still loyal servants of Persia, anachnu avadim aleha, and yet they declare their loyalty to God. They write this amana, this declaration, they sign it, and in this declaration they proclaim their loyalty to Shabbos and to the integrity and purity of marriage, etc. And so what Chazal are doing in Megillat Esther, again, is linking us to an era, to a period of time, where the entire scope of the story of Purim is part of the return of to a reevaluation of our relationship with God that allows us to be loyal to God, even though the temple is destroyed. And even though we've gone into exile, we are still able to frame the theology around loyalty to God. That's Sefer Nehemiah, and Chazal are reading that into Megillat Esther. So in short, and I'm going to stop here. I know we've gone over a few minutes, but in short, what I've tried to suggest and give you a bunch of examples for, and there are many, many more, is the idea that Chazal, in almost every case, many of these cases, where these kind of midrashim are so obscure and almost unintelligible on the face value, if we look at them deep and at a deeper level, we see biblical stories that serve as the backdrop to other biblical stories, not in the context of the place where Chazal are telling us this, but in other stories that Chazal are linking our eye to, drawing our attention to these kinds of patterns and these kinds of parallels. I'm sorry that I rushed to the last two examples. I kind of misjudged the time a little bit. I apologize for that. But the next two classes, next week and the week after Shavuot, we're going to move into a whole different genre altogether, which is the question of the personalities of Tanakh that are in our minds and in our mind are righteous, and yet the text describes them of having been guilty with so many offenses. How did Chazal see that? We're going to do the case in point. The classic example is we're going to look at David and Bathsheba and analyze that as a kind of a case study to the language that Chazal used in many of these instances. So we will spend the next two classes in that regard. If anybody wants my email, I will put it into the chat. So you have it, and welcome to reach out to me by email. I'm sorry that I didn't have time for questions today, but also we'll try to get online 15 minutes early next week in case anybody has any questions at that time. All right.
Shulman, and somebody did put in the chat, just in case everybody wasn't clear, somebody asked in the chat about extending the fast by a week, so maybe they missed that announcement before, and in case they missed it just now, Rabbi Shulman has graciously offered to extend the class to for another week post-Shavuot. Okay, so we do have two more classes. Okay?
Thank you.
Thanks, everybody, for coming. Thank you, Rabbi Shulman. Excellent, as always.
My pleasure.
So much to chew on.
My pleasure. Enjoy.
Sorry about the mishap at the beginning. We will get that right next week, and everyone can come on early if they have some questions, and we will be here. Have a great week.
You too.
All the best. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Have a good day. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Excellent.
Wonderful, wonderful share.
My pleasure.